good to have Rowan Connolly back with me to kick off the hour, and a happy new year. I haven't seen you, Rowan. Good to see you.
You too, Brett. Hi, everyone. Yeah, it's been a bit stop-start with us the last few weeks, hasn't it? Other engagements, I guess, but how are you travelling?
Not too bad.
Gearing up for the Aussie Open.
Yeah, well, you sort of feel like, you know, when you sort of do the lead-up events, you've almost done the Open before it even starts, but it's just a month of endurance, just a little sleep, but hey, we could be doing something worse, couldn't we?
Well, you got one advantage over most of us, Brett. You know how to pronounce all the names, and I'm doing a bit of hosting a week or so from now, so yes. I'm going to be brushing up on them.
Well, look, it's a mighty challenge, and I say to anyone out there, just ask a bit of advice, because otherwise you'll get yourself into a bit of a tangle, I reckon. I'm always interested to listen to newsreaders at this time of the year, and and hosts. I mean, obviously, tennis is my comfort zone, and I'm the same when it comes to certain other sports. You've just got to, yeah, double and triple check. But rest assured, most tennis names, you can say them two or three different ways, and it's okay.
Are
the
overs,
players actually accept it.
Are the overs and the itches from various geographical parts? So the overs tend to be Russian.
Yeah.
And the itches tend to be sort of Slavic,
yeah,
I think,
correct.
Don't they?
Yep.
Well, that's the start. It's just the preceding three syllables to get my head
so
around.
So last night, you know, Karolina Pliskova, or you can call her Karolina Pliskova, you know.
The inflection. Yeah,
she's
right.
Happy to go with both.
No, well, that's my homework for the next few days, I think. it's been a big week, hasn't it? I've been blogging the test cricket for The Age, and that I know everyone thinks I'm just sitting back in my undies on the couch, tapping away, but it's not visual imagery you really want. But it's full on. It is full on, particularly when a wicket goes. And then, of course, we had, you know, very sad, I think, above and beyond everything, news about James Hird during the week. And I actually had to sort of break into the blogging and weigh in on that, as I was asked to do. I pointed out to a lot of people and... Yeah, look, the ramifications of that story, I think, will be interesting in lots of ways, but perhaps most importantly about media coverage of events, because I think it's been a bit of an, hopefully it's been a bit of an eye-opener for a number of people. I've got to say, look, you know, at the risk of being a bit self-indulgent, I've copped a lot over, you know, what I wrote I think was reasonably sympathetic, but you don't really win many friends being part of the media. You're sort of tarred with the same brush. And all I can say is, you know, the media is a pretty large entity and there are a lot of different approaches that different people take to subject matter. And I'd like to think that I've been, you know, reasonably respectful of people's privacy and stuff like that over the years, and that the Essendon saga particularly, I'd like to think that I'd taken a middle ground at times. I think I've been pretty critical of Essendon and people involved, but I've also been, you know, hopefully not overly judgmental. So I understand it goes with the territory that people don't differentiate, but I found that a bit difficult actually, sort of copying it from all sides. I guess that's just par for the course.
Yeah, look, it is, and it's a sad story. There's no doubt about that. I mean, I certainly, Rowan, you know, never, you know, wanted to enter the media to be you know, parked outside someone's house and reports and hounding. And that part of it, I suppose, is the part that makes me feel the most uncomfortable.
Well, I think, you know, I talked about this with the Breakfast Guys the other day. I mean, the TV networks will say, well, you know, it's a visual medium and you know, we've got to have footage. But I'd argue if your footage is none more than a house in the background and you know it's not going to be any more than that, you know you're not going to get someone to suddenly come out and have a extended chat with you, then I would have thought the cons of doing that outweigh the pros. You stand somewhere else, you know, get someone to do a stand-up out the front of the Essendon Club or out the front of the AFL or, you know, just find another location. But I think the media as an industry has to get a lot better at drawing the line. One of the other difficult things with this is the, you know, the race to be first. So, you know, when the news sort of started filtering through about what had happened, I think a number of media organisations became aware of it. And then, you know, there was this sort of ethical thing about, well, you know, we've got to make the story solid. We've got to, you know, sort of confirm that this actually is the case. And that was really difficult. And then it became, well, you know, who's going to go first with it? And I was sitting there sort of blogging the cricket, keeping an eye on the websites and whatever. And I think, and I'm not pointing my finger at them, by the way, I think the Herald Sun were probably the first to publish it. I don't know if we'd heard that. I think Channel 7 had some information as well. But I guess, you know, as part of the Age, if the Herald Sun go with something like that, we have the same information. Well, it's a very, you know, I'd hate to actually be the person saying, okay, we need to publish it or we need to hold back. Because if we do hold back, well, then inevitably people say, well, why haven't you got this story?
Yep.
And I think to be honest, I think there's people in the public too who, whilst on one hand they say this is disgusting, invasion of privacy, they're also, I think in some cases, the same people who are desperate for information and clicking on the stories. And it's one of those things about human nature, isn't it? It's like driving past a car crash. You know, it's horrible, but you still can't help but glance at it.
Yeah. No, it's a good point. Where does it go from here, the whole James Heard situation? Obviously, you know, at the moment there's a total respect for his family and he's going through, obviously, a hell of a lot. And, you know, we've got a fair idea. I mean, that takes its toll. We know people personally in life, you know, Rowan, that things mount over a period of time and there's that scrutiny and that pressure on you that, you know, it's going to lead to people, you know, just breaking down and not being able to cope with that. I mean, you know, when I saw Lance Armstrong in New Zealand a couple of weeks ago, I think he did a ride there, and you think what he's been through and the public scrutiny, you know, and the cheating and everything else, how he's able to come out of it and live a normal life. And, you know, the more I read about the James Heard story, I mean, just such a decorated player and the great career, and I just wonder from the outside looking in how he is going to live a normal life and be able to just really flourish.
Well, it depends what you mean.
He's got so much living and so much of his work life.
Well, so much of his life, full stop,
correct,
left to go. He's a bloke in his 40s. It's not going to be the same life. It's clearly going to be a completely different life. And I think it's pretty sad that it'll, you know, I think it'll probably be a life far removed from one that involves something that he deeply loved and was passionate about, and that's the game of football. But look, I'd really hope, and I might be naive, but I'd hope that this episode is a bit of a line in the sand on this stuff for a number of people, not only in terms of, like, you know, now TV crews camped out in the front lawn, but in the way that we talk and write about stuff. Now, I've said this a number of times. A lot of this story I've sort of been at odds with a number of colleagues on our beliefs about what happened and the level of blame and et cetera. And, you know, I've been hammered on here for being too sympathetic to Heard. I've been hammered by people for being not sympathetic enough, you know. But I just think that there has to be, every journalist ideally has to have a line that they're not prepared to cross. And unfortunately, so competitive is the industry now that I think that line has been pushed back a bit, and not in a very comfortable way. But I would like to think that there, you know, there's areas where if I was told, you know, we want you to write something about blah, 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 I'd say, no, I'm sorry, I'm not prepared to do that. And it's easy for me to say that as a senior journalist who's been around a long time than if I was a younger person, one of those TV reporters being asked to stand out the front of the property. And that's another difficulty. But I think that, I don't know, the golden rule for me is that you're talking about someone's sporting life and you're talking about their capacities and abilities in that arena. That should never, I think, spill over into their other lives. And you know what I mean? You try to keep the two separate. And I think that's what happened with James Heard. I think such was a concentration on this story that it just became, everything became sort of thrown in together, and it did start to spill over into really highly personal and damaging and hurtful stuff about people's lives and their families. And I said, look, about my own organisation, I thought our news coverage of the story was fantastic, and it was awarded with various awards. I thought at times our commentary was a bit too personal and crossed a line. But that's how I saw it. Yep. Those people that wrote those pieces probably didn't see it the same way.
Let's have a chat at 19 past midday to Mario in Brunswick, who joins us. 9429 1116 if you want to jump on. Hi, Mario.
G'day, guys. How are you?
Good, Mario.
Yeah, lifelong Bomber member supporter. I'll try and be really quick here. What really, really affects me and hurts me and a lot of other Bomber supporters is that first thing is these stations like Channel 17, blah, 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 whoever, are sending these reporters out to be at Hurd's house, like after what happened the other day, right? That's the first thing. The second thing is 90% of the media. It might be including you, might not be, Rowan. I'm not here to have a go at you personally. But one of the females that you actually work with at the newspaper have hounded Hurd from day one. From day one, just giving it to him. All of a sudden, half of these other media scribes want to get on and say, oh, you've got to feel sorry for Hurdy and his family. It's a hard time. Mate, you can't have it both ways. First, you want to hound him, and then you want to say, you know, you've got to give him space and time and that. Look, this has been an absolute joke, and I blame the AFL, right, for wanting to go Hurd from day one, where we all know it should have been Dank and Robinson's were the ones who should have been copping what Hurd's copped.
Yeah, well, just if I could focus on the last thing you said there, I agree with you. I think I was on with Finey a while back, and we were talking about the sort of scale of villainy in this story, and I felt personally if you're drawing up a list of, you know, most wanted about it, I would have had Hurd certainly below Stephen Dank and Dean Robinson. And other people disagree with that. But as far as the AFL goes, I think the evidence is pretty clear that they were keen from a PR point of view to, I guess, make certain people the face of the scandal. And I think to that extent, I think he was a sacrificial lamb. Yep. And that's not to condone what he did and his lack of, you know, his lack of oversight of the program and his, playing a bit fast and loose with protocol. But it's not saying any of that was okay, because I don't think it was. But I think ultimately there's enough evidence in my mind that the program he wanted to pursue was a legal one, and that he was, ignorant to the overstepping of the mark by those other two people I mentioned. And one of the saddest ironies for me, Brett, is the fact that Hurd, given his status and his position,
yep,
became that focus for it. And, yeah, you know, do people really not believe that Stephen Dank is the villain, the biggest villain? I mean, he is the guy that has done this, and he hasn't just done it at Essendon. And yes, we treat him with contempt and a bit of a joke, but he's still essentially living the same sort of life he lived. His life hasn't been irrevocably changed what happened, whereas James Hurd's has.
Yeah, and that's the hard thing that, you know, I think to comprehend out of all of this. We need to take a break. 23 past 12. Happy for you to start any conversation you like in this hour on the world of sport. 9429 1116. Plenty of live sport on today. If you're following the NFL playoffs, Houston, of course, in the wild card round, the fourth seeds knocked out Oakland 27-14, and just underway Detroit and Seattle. We'll keep you right across those. Live tennis going on, A-League, NBL a little bit later on today, and of course a bit of cricket around the place, and of course the Road Nationals up in Ballarat. The elite men have just kicked off, so we'll be right across that with Mike Tomalaris through the afternoon. 9429 1116. You can give us a call here on Sunday Sports Central. 26 past 12 here on Sunday Sports Central. Rowan Connolly with me for the first hour. 94291116 if you want to jump on and have your say. 0433981116 on the SMS. Always got some good prizes to give away, and we'll keep you updated with all the live sport around the traps this afternoon. Nick said in Nary Warren. Welcome to you, Nick.
Hey, g'day, gentlemen. Hey, Rowan. Listen, I really enjoy your commentary. I love it. But don't... Alistair Clarkson is in charge at Hawthorn. Would that be a pretty good statement?
Yeah.
Yeah, you reckon Brendan Bolton's in charge of Carlton?
Well, of football matters, I think they are. Yeah,
I reckon he is. You reckon Fagan will be in charge of the Brisbane?
Yeah, line? Yeah, I get the point.
There you go. Okay, so the point is, who knew exactly what was going on? He'd already had associations with Charters years beforehand. The other thing that they fail to mention is, how about the self-injecting of the coaches in the rooms? Which is, Simon Goodwin was playing local football at that point in time. Who's to blame for that? Let me tell you, it's the coaches themselves. Who's at the top of the tree, mate?
No, well, I would still argue. I'm not denying your points. I would still argue that the person most to blame is the person who played with substances that others were unaware of. And I don't think a coach, even Alistair Clarkson, I don't think he would be across every little thing that his sports science people or his medical people were injecting or treating his players with. So I understand what you're saying to a point. I'm just talking about the scale of villains in this, and I would maintain that Stephen Dank was number one. And saying that doesn't clear James Hird of blame for responsibility. No. And I understand the thing. It's like cabinet responsibility, which actually is a principle that's been eroded as well. But, you know, you there has to be a front man, I guess, and James Hird was an obvious one. But I still would maintain that he wanted to run a program that was legal, not illegal.
Thank you, Nick. Dave in Ringwood on this topic as well. Hi, Dave.
Yep, hi. It's about James Hird. I think we should be protecting him and his family regardless of who's at fault, and that means the media who are harassing him and his family now, who are intruding on his family life and his personal life. If James Hird's got neighbours who are supportive or family who are there who are supportive, I wish they'd just put on their garden hoses on the front lawn and happen to water the on the street as well. And if the media gets soaked and it wrecks their cameras, then I'd be really happy about that. That's just what they deserve, and I wish they'd just go away. Media is responsible for 90% of what's happening to this poor guy and his family. That's all I need to say. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, no, look, I've certainly heard that view expressed a lot over the last few days. And, I wouldn't sort of condone vigilante-type activity. I'd also, like I said before too, I mean, most, I'd say nearly all these reporters who are gathered there, they're probably not in a position to be telling their bosses, no, I won't do it.
No.
So, if you want to direct your ire anywhere, it's probably more appropriately directed at the executives of the networks and the advertisers, I might add. That's always a powerful tool with TV and radio stations threatening the advertising revenue they get. So, emails to chief executives of media companies, that sort of thing. I mean, that to me would be preferable, but... Yeah, I understand where you're coming from.
Thank you, Dave. Billy in Greensboro at 12:30. Hi, Billy.
Hello there. Look, this is my first time ever in Talkback Radio, but it's an issue that I feel very strongly about. Something happened to me last week with a footballer. Am I allowed to name him?
Probably not.
Probably not until we hear what it was.
It's nothing detrimental. It's just something about privacy. Anyway, I've been a mad Essendon supporter all of my life, and I'm in my 70s and I go to the football. I love it. And what has happened to Essendon has devastated me. And quietly behind the scenes with my surrounding friends, we've grieved for the boys for the last 4-plus years. Anyway... one of the injured Footscray players was in a play centre, and I had my two grandsons last week, and a very, very well-known, I'm not allowed to name him?
No.
No, okay.
Not at this stage.
I beg your pardon?
Not at this stage, Bill. You can tell us the story, though.
That's fine. Anyway, he and his wife walked in, and my eldest grandson said, "Oh, Nan, that's such and such." And I said, "Yes," and I told him the name. And he went and he sat down with his wife and his little girls, and he was hounded. And my grandson said to me, "Nan, can I go over and take it?" This is before everybody recognised him, because we recognised him instantly. And Joshua said to me, "Can I go over and take a photo?" And I said, "No." I said, "That man is on holidays. He's reading a book. He's trying to look after his three little kids and participate in this jumping centre that we were at." And anyway, he was hounded. And in the end, he picked his book and his wife and they went and hid in a corner. And I said to Joshua, "Do you see what I mean? And are you sorry that Nan stopped you going over and getting a photo?" And he said, "Yes, Nan, I am." And I just thought that was very relevant.
Well, yeah, look, it's, I mean, it's not just footballers or sporting stars, you know, celebrities in general. They, I guess, they end up sort of forfeiting their right to have a private life. And some people,
in a lot of ways, yeah.
Yeah, and some people argue that, you know, if you're going to become rich and famous and whatever, that's a price you pay and you choose to pay that price. But you probably don't choose to pay that price, do you? I mean, like, you know what I mean? When you start out playing, say, AFL footy, you're not thinking, no. "I'm playing AFL footy because I want to become a celebrity."
No.
You get catapulted into that position, the better you perform.
Yep.
And you are, and you don't really have any say in controlling how people react to you, and you hope that people will give you space, and in some cases that's the case, but I think it's becoming less the case now. I think the whole, you know, the social media thing and everyone having cameras on their phones and that sort of thing, it really has made it even more difficult for people to have any sort of private life at all.
And I suppose for those people, and look, I can say, you know, calling footy here for a number of years, Rowan, you know, you and I work with ex-footballers and we travel interstate and you'll walk out of a ground and, you know, you're next to that footballer who gets instantly recognised, and some handle it differently to others. Some really embrace it and are happy to have a conversation. Some are trying to shy away from it and they can't because they're obviously recognisable. But, you know, you've either got to find a way to just embrace it or, I suppose, it's not an easy existence to have.
No, and I think, one name comes to mind, Dermy. You know, Dermy.
I was going to mention his name.
Well, he is as good as anyone I've ever seen at handling it, but I think he is good at handling it because he enjoys it.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, I think good on him for enjoying it. He was really good at something and that catapulted him to celebrity status and he thinks, you know, this is a pretty good life, you know, and people like me and they want to speak to me and he's happy to be part of that. I mean, even Dermy would have his moments where he just wants to be alone, I'm sure, but you know, when he's in that sort of environment, I think he's wonderful at how he deals with people.
Well, but that just typifies the character of different human beings. I mean, some people are just naturally inquisitive, aren't they? So Dermy knows that the focus is on him. But one thing I've noticed about Dermy, he can quickly turn the focus onto the person that he's having a conversation with. So he's interested in them, whereas others who are in the spotlight couldn't give a continental about, you know, Tom, Dick or Harry.
And that is an amazing ability. And I can tell you, as someone who's been one of the sort of starstruck people in that situation, not with Dermy, I've spent too much time with him, but when someone does that, when they're able to sort of ask you about yourself and Dermy's capacity to remember things about people too and have a point of contact with them, it makes you warm to them as people. And I guess then, when you have difficulties, it makes people more sympathetic to you.
Mm.
But if I'm going to contextualise that with James Heard, I've always found James Heard in a public arena very, very affable and happy to chat and whatever too. And don't forget, Brett, and I did mention this the other day as well, the way he carried himself publicly throughout the 4 years, it was absolutely remarkable given the extent of the pressure he was under. There were times when I was watching him under assault, you know, at press conferences and things, just thinking, how are you holding this together? And he did, but I think that it took a toll.
Yeah.
I think in the end it really took a toll.
Let's take a break and we'll we'll focus a bit on the cricket in the last part of Rowan's
half. Can you talk to cricket?
9-4, 2-9, 11-16, because for mine, really disappointing the Pakistanis. I mean, full credit to Australia. I think they've been terrific. It's been a great rebound from losing that test in Hobart, and I like the team that's come together, and hopefully that team might be able to have some sustainable success. But I'm just sick of these subcontinent teams coming to Australia and just almost just waving the white flag, and they wanted to go home.
Well, I think it's 12 tests in a row we've beaten Pakistan now.
Yep.
Yeah, no doubt. They were, in the end, disappointing, particularly after the fight back in Brisbane. But on the other side of the coin, yeah, great signs for Australia and a remarkable turnaround from the devastation of Hobart, I think.
Absolutely. 23-1, you're listening to Sunday Sports Central. Rowan Connolly with me in the studio, and you can be a part of it. 9-4, 2-9, 11-16. Good to be here as our temperature dips. Nice little cool change coming through on a Sunday afternoon. 9-4, 2-9, 11-16. You can join us anytime or send us a text. 0433 98 11 16. Rowan Connolly back with me to open the hour here on Sunday Sports Central, who's been blogging, of course, the test for The Age in the last few days. Been a great turnaround from Australia, of course, after losing that Hobart test, winning in Adelaide against South Africa, of course, winning the one-day series, and now the three test series against the Pakistanis. And I suppose it all unravelled really in Melbourne, and then by the time they got to Sydney, it's almost like they were just totally shot, Pakistan.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, what you said before the break, I agree with. Pakistan particularly have been, over the years, historically pretty flaky, haven't they? And they'll pull out an amazing performance, and we saw that at the Gabba. I mean, they nearly pulled off what would have been close to the greatest test win of all time, and then imploded on the last day in Melbourne because they went into that final day's play thinking, well, this is clearly going to be a draw. And then in Sydney, it was really from the first session of that game via Dave Warner's century before lunch, which, you know, gee, there was so much great cricket played during the Sydney test. You know, Warner's innings, Renshaw, Hanscom again, the bowling. I thought Josh Hazlewood's last couple of tests, he really emerged almost as our number one bowler, I think, ahead of Mitch Starc.
So what's he taken, about 31 across the six?
I think 30-odd, yeah. And his figures yesterday, he had, was it 2 for 23 off 18 or something, was it?
Yeah, 3 for 29 off 18.2 overs.
Yeah. I mean, he accurate, lots of danger to the batsman, had him playing and missing.
Yep.
Everything you want in a fast bowler. So he's been a wonderful find. But for me, I just if you go cast your mind back to Hobart, and that was as low a point as Australian cricket had been at for 30 years, I reckon, since the mid-80s. The ground we've made since, and how have we done it? I reckon we've done it on the back of youth, and we've reverted to tradition, really. And as a kid growing up, and yes, it's a long, long time ago, but I used to love the fact that our sides were a lot younger than England's side, for example, and we backed the precocious young up and comers and got a lot of success out of that. And I think one thing that really struck me in Sydney was the number of Australian players being interviewed who talked about Hazlewood was one of them, talked about the spirit in the dressing room now. And this group has really come together, and I think it's really important that they keep the crux of this team together for as long as possible.
So not only youth, it seems like they've just brought in guys of, this is purely from the outside looking in, substantial character. I mean, when I've heard Peter Hanscom interviewed, I've never seen a man look more comfortable in a baggy green than Peter Hanscom. He just looked like he's ready-made. I mean, he had to do his apprenticeship and bide his time. His name was sort of in discussions there for quite a period. Yes, he bats a little bit unconventionally, but hey, Steve Smith's averaging 60 in Test cricket, and certainly not from the Greg Chappell textbook. And then young Renshaw at 20 just looks beyond his years.
Yeah, he does.
And to think there's a conversation going on that maybe India is not, you know, the place for him to go. I mean, surely you've got to reward the form. And okay, if it doesn't quite work out for whatever reason, you have a backup plan. Let's have a chat to Richard in Cowes at 16-1. Richard.
Good afternoon, guys. Look, Rowan, you just mentioned about India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka. Look, they're all right when they play on their baby wickets with a ball that doesn't bounce above knee height, but you get the ball up around throat height. They've never won a test series in this country ever, the three of them.
Is that right? India haven't either?
No, no, India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka have never won a Test series in this country.
No, I think India drew a few years ago, didn't
they?
They've never won.
Yeah.
Series ever.
Yeah, no, it's a fair point. I remember, again, going right back, but during the World Series cricket split when Bob Simpson captained Australia, we had a wonderful series against India where we won the first two tests and then they won very convincingly in Melbourne and Sydney, and it came down to the fifth test in Adelaide and we won that only just. But, yeah, I think that's about as close as they've come. There might have been mid-80s, about 85, 86. I reckon they might have gone all right here. We might have drawn or beaten them. But
India. And I think there was when Ganguly was captain, there was, a four-test series. It was 2-2.
Yeah.
Going back, about a decade ago now.
But, yeah, look, you're right, Richard. And I think that's become sort of a trend of cricket with everyone, really, hasn't it? I don't have the figures in front of me, but I wonder how many sides have won series away from home over the last decade?
But
I don't reckon it'd be that many.
Yeah, just their difficulty with facing the conditions here. But one thing it's never really improved, although I watched India against England, I reckon India certainly as a fielding team are a hell of a lot better. And they're led by, Virat Kohli is just a great athlete. So no doubt he's inspiring them. But the Pakistani fielding, now they've got Steve Rixon in there.
Yeah.
To purely work on fielding. And still just subpar.
That was appalling, wasn't it? And the tone was set there, I think, on day one when Misbah let one go through his legs. Yeah. But, in defence of him, he's a 40-year-old. Yunus is up around that mark as well. So that doesn't help. But, yeah, a number of drop chances and misfields, and they just look generally sort of unathletic in the field, didn't they?
Neil and Altona Meadows. Hi, Neil. How are you going?
Oh, well, how you going, guys?
Good.
Just Hanscom, the way he kept on the, when Crook. But he's also a keeper. Would he be the next Gilchrist, try him in a one-dayer?
Well, they spoke to him about when was the last time he'd kept, and I think might have been practice going at the start of a season, but I don't think he's too keen on the idea, and you can understand that because I think at the elite level, to suddenly move your focus from one area of the game to two is pretty difficult, and why someone like Gilchrist was such a remarkable test cricketer. And particularly being new into the team, would that be a level of pressure too much, I think? But
yeah, look, he's batting higher up, isn't he?
So yeah.
He's batting, what did he bat at, five? Where did he come in?
Five and Cartwright six.
So Gilchrist was batting at seven and keeping. So
yeah, Sangakkara, I guess, is a good example of, someone who could do both and bat at an elevated position as well. It's a tough thing to ask, I think, now, particularly with the level of scrutiny on test, every aspect of test cricket now. Having said that, when he did take over from Wade, he was very neat with the gloves, wasn't he?
Yep.
Didn't it look weird, him wearing the pads on the inside of his whites? I couldn't get my head around that at all.
Well, he's a beauty, though. Absolute beauty in Australia, dominant. But the ultimate test now comes going to India, who have come off a great series win against England and always difficult to play, and obviously with what happened in Sri Lanka last year and how we played the spinners. So, yeah, the ultimate test certainly to come. The Big Bash last night, the Stars, KP turned it on. I'd love to actually hear from anyone who went there. The big jumbo screens there last night looked like a full house. And 9-4, 2-9, 11-16, the Stars obviously a little bit too good. And, well, that's what he's paid the big bucks to do, Kevin Peterson. Come out here and playing innings where it's needed most, and the Stars needed him to stand up last night.
I've got to say, BP, I was sitting there watching it and sort of wondering whether formats like this reduce our attention spans further, because there haven't been too many T20 games where I've started getting bored, but I did towards the end because it was so obvious such a long way out that the Stars were going to win handsomely. Great knock from him, and plenty to back it up, and the Renegades beat them as convincingly on, New Year's Day at the MCG, didn't they?
Yeah.
I guess that's the nature of T20 cricket. You get a good start and it sort of sets you up and it's hard to pull back. But, what was the crowd there last night? Was it full house?
The crowd, if I can just find it here,
it was probably high 40s.
44,189.
Yeah, look, that's a great turnout. Continues to pull the numbers. There's no question about that.
I like the fact we've just talked about some of the test inclusions, and now Chris Lynn gets his opportunity. He's just dominated for the Brisbane Heat. His innings. I was in doing evenings the other night when he made 98 off 49.
That was unbelievable.
You're trying to do a show, and I was that distracted watching this guy descend to all parts. I think he hit 11 sixes.
Mm.
So he's picked himself in the team. And as Darren Lehman said yesterday, well, Aaron Finch, sorry, mate, you haven't got it done in recent times, and George Bailey too, that were permanent fixtures. So I think the additions into the different formats, you know, there's some good characters coming in. I mean, Lynn looks like a great fella who obviously can play, but also has some pretty good character about him as well. So I think the next period looks pretty fruitful for Australia.
Certainly in the short form of the game. It's interesting to me how many of those guys are capable of transitioning into the Test arena. Now, we really have still only got the one, haven't we, Dave Warner? And it even took him a number of years to do it.
Mm.
He has done it, though, and he's rewritten the rule book on batting in Test cricket. So
yes,
it's funny about how we view the impact of the short form on the longer form of the game, because
yep.
I reckon after Hobart, you know, I was certainly sitting there thinking, you know, haven't those guys got the patience to compile an innings anymore? Whereas you watch Warner knock up a ton before lunch on day one in Sydney, and you go, gee, hasn't the short form of the game really added to Test cricket? you can't have it both ways, I suppose. You've got to take the good with the bad.
Exactly right. Gee, James Pattinson last night, I mean, just that body has been held by a string for a long time. He was up around the 140s last night. I don't know if you saw the ball that went right through Bob Quine. He came out and answered beautifully, made 51 off 30, but absolutely copped it where it hurts most.
Yeah. He's quick. I mean, one of the great, not tragedies, but it's been pretty sad that we haven't been able to see Pattinson and Cummins open the bowling in a Test match for Australia.
Yeah.
Because that, to me, was, you know, Lillian Thompson reborn. But, you know, we've been talking about that for 5 years now, and it still hasn't happened. So hopefully, you know, he can hold it together. Because we're starting to see Cummins get his body together now and getting a bit more endurance and longevity. And interestingly, talking about the tour of India coming up, Dean Jones wrote a really good piece in The Age yesterday about it, but he's very much of the view that they should take Cummins. And if they're worried about him breaking down, well, he's got 6 months to get over it before the Ashes next summer anyway. Take him. He's very much of the view that our best pace bowling, quality pace bowling, will be a far bigger weapon in India than ordinary spin bowling. And I tend to agree.
Let's have a chat to Daniel on the road at 8-1. Hi, Daniel.
Yeah, hi, guys. Great show. I love the discussion on James Hird before and now at the cricket. And I just wanted to say that, you know, I'm a child of the 70s, and I grew up watching the Victorians, Dav Watmore, Ian Moss, and all these guys that year after year played brilliantly.
Hang on, Daniel, just got to pick you up there. Jeff Moss was the cricketer. Ian Moss was the lead guitarist of Cold Chisel.
Sorry, Jeff Moss.
But they were both good. They were both good.
Yeah. I'm getting my wife to use the Chisel Boys. But, you know, Dav Watmore and all these guys that played for 10, how many years, year after year, 1,000 runs, and they never got a sniff. I think Watmore got a sniff right at the end, and he was probably past it. It's just so good to see these young guys who now they get picked on merit, and the guys in the Test team, even though, you know, it's hard to get in, they might get given a little bit more leeway. If they don't perform, they're out. And I think that's so good for cricket, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, to have that encouragement to be rewarded for form. And, you know, there's always been hard luck stories. Jamie Siddons, I think, is possibly the biggest hard luck story Australian cricket's seen. He just had the misfortune to be around at a time when we were flush with great batsmen.
Yep.
I remember you're talking about Dav Watmore. He ended up making his Test debut, I think, during the World Series cricket split, 78-79. We played England in the Ashes, and then we played two Tests against Pakistan. And I think he and Moss both played in those two Tests against Pakistan. That might have been about it.
Yeah, and he's coached just about every country in the world.
Well, he led Sri Lanka to the World Cup in 96.
He coached Pakistan. I reckon last time we spoke to him, I reckon we had him on breakfast about 12 months ago. He was coaching Zimbabwe. I'm not sure where he is right now, Dev, but he's been around the globe.
He's a great man, Dev Watmore.
Let's take our final break of the hour. We'll come back and wrap up with Rowan Connolly. Time for a call or two, 9429 1116, leading up to 1 o'clock. Welcome back to Sunday Sports Central as we come up to 1 o'clock. Interestingly, a few of the Geelong boys are doing the Lawn Peter Pub yesterday.
5,000 people, I think, did that. A couple I know, too. You won't catch me doing that with the Sharks in
I had the helicopters over top. And I'll tell you what.
Hey, just quickly, we haven't talked about soccer yet today. The I was flicking between the Big Bash and the Victory Adelaide game. Mm. Did you see the Victory goals? Class goals,
yes,
both of them.
Yeah, Berisha and Troisi. Yeah.
Troisi particularly. Just hit it first time on the left foot, curled it beautifully into the top left corner, and Berisha's header, same thing. And they're going pretty well, the Victory. I reckon a lot of people were doubtful about how they were going to go this season, and they're holding up brilliantly.
Yeah, it was Kevin Muscat said last night, even back in round two when they hadn't started well, he did say at his press conference then he actually thought they were playing pretty well, but just not getting the result, not finding the back of the net. So, no, they've just built nicely now and just starting to put a bit of pressure on Sydney FC.
Well, when that the first derby against City, which might have been the second game of the season when they got hammered, I think it was 4-1 in the end, was it? Even that was a high-quality game. They didn't play that badly. It's just that City played out of their skins. But I think they're, as a team, they just seem to be combining a lot better. And I must say, I'm tending to watch all their games closer now because my son is right on board the Victory, but I'm getting on board. I wouldn't call myself a bona fide fan yet, but I love watching certain players on that side. You know, Rojas, I think, is classic. Probably the best player in the competition.
Yep.
So they're good to watch. And I think the standard generally, the A-League, is really good to watch these days.
Well, when you look at Adelaide, who are last year's champion, sitting on the bottom, they are certainly not the worst team going around.
Nah.
I mean, I think there was a stat, the boys mentioned Teo Pelissieri and JP Howcroft last night, that at the same stage last year, Central Coast, who went on to have a horror season, there was a big difference in the goal difference and the amount of wins. And this is a team that everyone keeps saying, gee, they could just get on a roll, finals might be out of the equation. They're clearly on the bottom of the table.
Well, even last night, they had far more shots at goal than the Victory did, and yet it's just about putting them away.
Well, they might just run out of time. But in saying that, the top four have got a bit of a buffer, and then it could be a bit of a logjam if Adelaide can get on a roll, because Perth are inconsistent. Newcastle are in six, but no guarantee to stay there.
Yeah. Well, right at the moment, you'd say Sydney FC versus Victory in the grand final, and that'd be an absolute cracker.
A beauty. Thanks, Ro.
Cheers, BP.